I'm so in the dark, Ken. Can you bring me up to speed?
Well, if you're a member of the working poor, and that would be everybody that works in restaurants or cuts hair or does nails or, you know.
Yes.
Those people are destroyed economically.
Oh, totally destroyed. And I love, so I was just curious about these programs that they were coming up with. Moratoriums on mortgages and car payments. So this one property I have is a rental that is,
oh yeah,
thank God, 28th of this month is sold. That's out of my hair, but
congrats.
It's been empty for a year. So I'm paying the mortgage and all the costs. So I contacted the mortgage company. They're like, oh yeah, we have this special plan. You can stop paying for 3 months. I'm like, great. I'm going to do it. Oh, by the way, at the end of those 3 months, then you owe us that whole amount that you didn't pay for the 3 months.
I'm glad they told you, because a lot of people aren't getting the second part of that message. And there's going to be a lot of foreclosure. I mean, oh my God. Yeah.
That is just a crime. Like, okay, thank God I'm in a position that I can continue paying this. But what if somebody is out of work for 2 months? They can't pay their mortgage. What good is this 3 month moratorium going to do? You know what it's going to do? It's just going to destroy them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's criminal. I get so upset about this stuff. It's criminal. What's going on? It's been going on a while, but it just seemed to be like they took, to quote an obscure movie, they turned it up to 11 when this COVID thing hit.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. All those stuff was all swirling around before, but they put it up to 11. But I mean, let's see. We have in our little village, we have this cafe that was the community hub. That's where you met people. That's where you put up your signs if you wanted to do a yoga class or offer babysitting. You know what I mean? They're out of business. They're gone. They're done. They're finished. I'm talking to my printer. His business came from restaurants, churches, the local college, and fraternal organizations doing live fundraisers, banquets, and so on. He's done.
Done.
I had a friend with a restaurant, 20 years, Brooklyn, 35 employees. You know, she was taking the money and doing all kinds of great things for the community there and up here. Done. She's finished. My acupuncturist, who kept me out of pain and really helped me, fantastically. And I used to sit in the waiting room and see the other people who were really fucked up, and he was really good. He hasn't been able to touch a patient in 2.5 months. And yesterday he said he's not sure he's going to, like, if his profession will even exist. And I'm like, dude, they can't stop acupuncture forever. But I mean, imagine, like, I'm going to guess he treated 100 people a month, let's say conservatively, right? There's 18,000 acupuncturists in the country. That's 1.8 million people.
Wow.
Right? Who are in pain. Because you don't go to an acupuncturist because you just need needles stuck into you. Because you don't have anything else to do. Let me give this guy $100 to stick needles in me.
Right.
And that's just an acupuncturist. What about physical therapists? Because I was in that world. I was, you know, on a cane, on crutches for months. If somebody had told me I couldn't get physiotherapy for 2 months, three, I mean, anyway, ranting.
And you're just talking about in your community. And then we're not even figuring in the, how that is affecting other people and other businesses just in that community, then multiply that worldwide. And I don't know, man. It just seems like we're fucked.
Yeah. I mean, they keep, you know, I hate to hear people say the world as we know it has changed forever. But you know what? I guess it has. But not because of a virus.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Not because of a virus.
Yeah. And we're going to be, you know, you mentioned that you're doing well. I'm doing great. It's not hurting me at all. I'm making more money than ever.
Like people now need to hone in on their marketing more than ever. And it's, even though I said I wasn't going to do it, my people are asking for, tell us market research stuff. Tell us launching new businesses stuff. Because I said, I stopped teaching that because I don't want to attract, you know, that internet marketing crowd.
Right.
But these are people who have either have a current business that's tanking.
Yeah.
Had a business that, I mean, like your restaurant you're talking about, they're out of business.
Yeah.
And they have to start something new.
Yeah. So we're doing great. But I'm not happy. I'm not happy to see all these people getting blown up.
No kidding. And my thought is, well, you know, I'm relieved. I expected my business to start tanking. I thought this is 2008 again. I'm going to see it cut in half when I have, like when I have my supplement business.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm happy for myself, but then I look at the rest of the world and everybody else, I'm thinking, well, you know, they're screwed and eventually it's going to affect us all. So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it takes so hard for a family to pull itself out of poverty. You know, like my VA, I got a virtual assistant in the Philippines. So they've been putting one of the sons through school to get a degree so that he can be some kind of medical technician. You know, it's been going on for like 3 years and they're paying big money for this education. There's no jobs now. They just blew 3 years. You know, he could have been working. He could have been, you know, making money, and he wasn't. He was in school, and they took the little meager money they have and put this other son through this thing, and now there's no work.
Wow.
It's a catastrophe for these people. You know, they're not going to get a check for, I mean, here's my check.
You got one?
I got one.
I didn't get one.
Did you get automatic deposit?
No.
Neither. Wow.
I filed an extension for 2019 that I still haven't filed yet, but maybe that's why.
No, I didn't file either. I always file late. Little tip for everybody listening, if anybody's listening. If you file on time, you increase your odds of getting audited exponentially.
That's what my accountant told me, which was good news for me because I was always late anyway.
I always find the tax thing just maddening. I don't think that way. You know, I just take the money and put it in the bank. I don't think about anything else, how I got it or what I spent to get it, or I just want to make sure there's more in the bank than there was last month, and then I'm good. I know I'm winning. So anyway, I don't know what to do. I'm probably going to do a show just about this check, like because to me it's blood money. I mean, I'm glad to have. I don't need it. I'm not going to burn it. I'd like to set it on fire.
That'd make a great video.
Yeah. But it seems maybe that's not the right thing to do. So maybe I'll do some contest where I'll give it away. I don't know.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
But to me, it's blood money. It's like, hey, we ruined your community and all your fellow small business people. Here's $1,000 or whatever this is, $1,200. And I feel like if I cash it, I'm agreeing to what happened. I don't know. I have a strange mind.
Did you hear about, I forget the name of the program, but it's offered through the SBA. The producer I was working with on my album told me about it. He goes, oh, I'm filing for that. They'll give you up to the equivalent of whatever you pay in salaries, the equivalent of that multiplied by 2.5. And they say if you use that money to pay salaries and your mortgage and stuff like that, it's 100% forgivable. Well, I looked into it. And there was an application to get in line, not to apply for the money, but to get in line with my business, the bank I use for my business.
Yeah.
When it's available. So I just submitted my email to get in line. They sent updates. Basically they said, you know, we're not going to participate in this. The banks don't want to deal with it. And what happened anyway, what they did, small businesses didn't get a freaking penny. It all went to the really big guys who owed tens of millions to the banks. So the banks shuttled the money to them so that those guys could pay what the banks were owed.
Yep.
It was just a big freaking scam.
Yep. Yep.
And, you know, and I told my wife, she's like, well, we should file, you know, anyway, just in case. The business side. I'm like, let me tell you something. That money comes with, I heard a Pentecostal preacher say this one. You know, those shekels come with shackles.
Yeah.
And I thought, no matter what they say, you know, our business is doing fine. But she's like, just in case, we should apply. Nah. There's conditions that will come with that that we don't even want to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, you probably open yourself up for an audit.
Oh, for sure.
You think they're going to, you know, they're going to say, hey, we gave you this money. Now we're wondering if you were really entitled to it. Oh, look, you didn't declare this employee. I just heard from a guy. The guy, he runs a burger joint in town. He's still alive. He does takeout. And I go in and he locks the door and he takes his mask off and I sit and I eat in the freaking restaurant without a mask.
Love it.
Yeah. So anyway, he hired a guy for $500 to do some job. 3 years later, the state of New York came by and fined him $2,500 for not paying the unemployment insurance on that guy's $500 one-time payment to do a little contract job.
Unbelievable. So, I mean, I say unbelievable. Yeah, of course it's believable. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
You know what I was thinking this morning? I don't know the numbers. This was just a thought that popped into my head. I was thinking, I wonder if just 1% stops paying the income tax and just like, you know, not in a spiteful way, just like, hey, you know what? I no longer choose to be a slave. So go to hell, whatever happens, happens. Like just if 1% stopped paying it, I wonder if that whole house of cards would just topple.
It's interesting. It's interesting. Because they, you know, they have, as you know, because of your former profession, you know, you can make any law you want, but you got to be able to enforce it. And the enforcing isn't just sending letters and sending, you know, guys to pick you up. There's a court process and there's trials, there's pretrial, there's trials. What if everybody wanted to go to trial?
Oh, they could never handle it.
You know, that's how the civil rights work. People don't, it's funny, they always talk about the unessential and they leave out the essential. The way the civil rights movement worked was they all went and got arrested and they all demanded a trial. And even though they were considered subhuman by the Southern, you know, gentry down there, they still had to follow that law.
And that's brilliant.
They couldn't have 600, 700, 2000 trials, you know? So they had to make some kind of a deal. So that would be the way. Hey, I want to do a quick public service announcement about mask wearing, you know?
Oh, good.
Okay.
Are we live? Like, are people listening?
I mean, I'm recording. No, we're not live. We're not live. Okay. But I am recording it. We may not use any of this, but I mean, we'll get to the serious stuff soon, I guess. But who knows? You know, sometimes there's good stuff in the back and forth, right?
In the behind the scenes.
I'll allow you to watch it and anything you think is not good, we'll take it out. Don't worry.
I don't think I've said anything too incriminating so far.
No, we're just talking. So mask, right? So you put the mask on. First of all, in a hospital setting, when you put masks on, you put them on a very particular way. You grab the elastic and you put them over your ears. You don't touch the mask. You got to do it careful. And when you take the mask off, you have to do it the same way. You don't ever touch the front of the mask. Why not? Well, if the front of the mask is designed to block the flow of pathogens, the mask is going to accumulate pathogens, right?
Makes perfect sense.
Right? Now, so if you grab the mask like 99.999999% of the people are doing, you have completely defeated the purpose in wearing a mask. You're supposed to take it off by the elastic very carefully, then take it and drop it in the trash. How many people are putting these masks on and then having a cup of coffee and then putting them back on or taking them off to smoke a cigarette? That's my favorite one. Like, the guy's trying to save his life from the virus and he's there, you know, smoking, vaping, you know. So that's number one. Number two, this is going to be a shocker to most people on TV telling us what to do. We need oxygen to function properly, right? So the mask absolutely blocks oxygen. No question about it, right? We're also supposed to get rid of carbon dioxide because we're not plants. right? Plants love, you know, we're not plants, we're animals, right? So now they may have changed that, you know, that may have changed, but last I checked, we're still, we're supposed to get rid of carbon dioxide. So what wearing a mask does is reduce the amount of oxygen you get and increase the amount of carbon dioxide in your system. That's not healthy by any standard, and you don't need to go to Harvard Medical School to know that, right? But that's not all. When you're wearing a mask, all the pathogens that you have, and we're all carrying pathogens all the time. I know there's this theory that we're pristine and this COVID virus came from outer space and jumps into us and ruins the party. We're all carrying crap all the time, and we're dealing with it. It's called the immune system, right? So when you put the mask on, all those pathogens are coming out in your breath, and they're collecting on the inside of your mask, which means when you're breathing, you're taking pathogens right up your nasal passage, and you're filling your nasal passage with pathogens. You don't need a Harvard Medical degree to know that this is true, right? Which is why if you're a union painter in New York State pre-COVID, you were not allowed to wear a mask on a job unless you'd been to a cardiopulmonary specialist, MD, who did a complete evaluation of you and signed off that you were healthy enough to wear a mask. These are healthy working men, right? So how many old people do you see who are 1 foot in the grave already walking around wearing masks 24/7? How many sick people? They're already sick. They're sick. They've had lung cancer. They have emphysema. They've got COPD, whatever that thing is, wearing masks. They should not be wearing masks. An ethical doctor would tell them, you should not wear a mask. Have you heard any of this on TV?
Not a thing.
Has anything I said sounded crazy and wild and tin hat conspiracy theories?
It not at all. It makes perfect sense.
Do I seem like I'm making stuff up just to be a Trump red state Republican?
Let me see. Lower the oxygen you take in, up the carbon dioxide you take in. Not a good combination.
Accumulate pathogens on a piece of cloth that you're breathing all day.
Directly into your sinuses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, in a real hospital setting, people are putting those masks on, doing what they need to do, and taking them off right away and throwing them away. And then if they have to go do something else, they put a fresh one on. How many people are wearing the same mask every day? The little cloth mask with the red, white, and blue.
I see people driving in their cars with their masks on. I'm serious.
We got that up here too. I see people, I mean, I'm in the country, right? I'm in the dead, and this is country. In fact, I went to a friend's house, drove an hour. I think I saw three people on the street in an hour of driving, okay? And I see people, so that's where I live. I see people on bicycles, no one around for miles, in the country, wearing masks as they're riding a bicycle. It's sad. It shows how gullible people are. I mean, in a way, it shows how trusting and cooperative people are. Like, they think they've been told this is a good thing to do.
And just automatically accept it without question.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if anything, to me, this shows the average human being is basically a nice, cooperative, helpful person. And the average elite is a psychopathic scumbag. I mean, if it wasn't clear to me before that, I think I've got it, you know.
Pretty much sums it up.
Yeah.
You know, I guess that's a good thing that the average person is a nice, easygoing person who wants to do right. But, you know, we talked about earlier, like if 1% of the people just stop paying income tax, would the whole system just collapse?
Yeah.
What would happen would be, you know, it would have to be the 1% who's like super strong or just finally made the decision. I've had enough. Because what would happen is they get a letter. All they get is a letter. It'd be some computer generated letter. Some the lowest level IRS employee would go, oh, okay, this letter needs to go to this list. And that's all it would be. There'd be no teeth. There'd be no due process. Nothing would come of the letter. But a good percentage of those people will get that letter and immediately be in fear and like, oh crap, what? Forget it. I give up. I'm going to pay my income tax.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's like how compliant most people are.
Yeah. And you mentioned the magic word fear. Yeah. That's
fear
what this
is what makes it happen. Fear is what, you know, wow, that is what has changed everything practically overnight is just fear.
And you know, this is so much like, let me ask you this question. Have you ever heard anybody tell the following story? I had a little pain, ache, or whatever. I went to my doctor, and he said, it's a good thing you came in because dot, 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 dot. Have you ever heard that story?
All the time.
Okay. Do you think that maybe that's sort of like a, do you want fries with that kind of line that doctors have learned and just use reflexively and actually doesn't mean fuck all?
You know, that's a good observation. I hadn't thought of that.
Mm-hmm. It justifies whatever crazy ass procedure or drug or whatever they want to put you through. Right?
Yeah. Although I wonder if it was implanted, right? Like, or conditioned somewhere along the line from the drug reps. Maybe, I don't know. I'm just speculating. It came from the drug reps, you know, with enough repetition and they hear that from various places, maybe it'll just become the automatic response then, right?
Well, we know in every profession, right? Whatever the job is that you're dealing with the public, you have to come up with pat lines to get over, right? I mean, you don't have to. You could be ethical and actually explain things to people. But a lot of people aren't doing that. They just come up with like, oh, we've never heard of this before. We've never had anyone complain about that before. How many times do we hear that? Like some company has delivered this customer service travesty, and you know they've done it to a million people. And the rep tells you, gee, that's we've never heard that complaint before.
See, we've never heard the complaint that your order didn't arrive before.
Or that your food was cold.
Yeah.
Or that the burger wasn't cooked through and it was red inside when you asked for well done, you know. So I think there's people that are healers and there's people that are in the medical profession. And I think the medical profession runs on scaring the daylights out of people. And if you successfully scare the daylights out of people, you can get them to say, yes, I'll go on chemo, or yes, I'll go through this operation, or yes, I'll, you know, give you untowards amount of money, or yes, I'll shut my economy down for an indefinite period of time while you guys handle it. I mean, I think really that's what this is all about.
Yep, you're right. It's just accepting whatever's being presented to them. I watched The Truman Show again a couple nights ago. Have you ever seen that movie?
You know, I need to watch it again. I haven't seen it since it came out.
I haven't seen it a bunch of times. That was probably my third time I've seen it. But, you know, it's just like Christoph says when he's interviewed, you know, the producer of the show, he's like, Truman accepts the reality that's presented to him. And I think like most of the people just do that. The other half is outside right now talking to her family. So I can say this, my mother-in-law has Parkinson's, right? And so, you know, the medicines have done nothing but make to really cause problems and not make the Parkinson's better. So it was proposed, and this is a fairly new procedure in Colombia. They've been doing it a while here. Like, hey, how about we crack open your skull and we cram this chip in there? Okay, so now you're going to be part Android. You're going to have a computer chip in your head. You don't have this thing up here. We can tweak it and control it. You know what she said? Yeah, let's do it. No research.
Oh, my God. No, I know. No, I know. No research. I mean, no research.
Nothing. Like, not even, let me just Google this to see if the people who've had this done, how they're faring. No, just accept whatever's presented. Like, yeah, sign me up.
That story tells it all. That's kind of what it is for most people. I mean, I don't know why I'm so skeptical, but I mean, I think there are a lot of people that know what they're doing, but I've just been in business too long to know that there's a whole lot of people that don't know what they're doing, but put up a great front. And I assume that's true for doctors and the medical profession as well, and medical science. That's just in my DNA at this point.
I've learned that in business too. Like some people get really, really good at putting up the front, you know, they get really, really good at promoting themselves as a fill in the blanks expert or guru. And, you know, you hope they're competent at the skill they're claiming that they're expert at, but in a lot of cases they're not. But that, that deception that they're putting forth is sufficient to convince people to give them money.
Yeah.
And I think that probably applies throughout a lot of professions.
Yeah. And it's not just money in the medical world. It's your life. You're giving your life to these guys. You know, Ted Nicholas, the great Ted Nicholas, who passed away recently, he said this thing directly to me. I was lucky. I got to talk with him. And he said, you know, Ken, only 1 out of 10% of vendors actually knows anything about what they're doing.
I believe that.
Yeah, which is and that, you know, and because I was young when I heard the younger when I heard that. And I guess I was still naive. And I thought, well, most people that hang out a shingle actually can do what they say they can do. And he said, oh, no, Ken, you're lucky if it's 1 out of 10. Like, oh. And that made me feel better, too, because I'd had some bad experience with vendors. And you often, it's so easy if you're not strong mentally to think that, oh, it's me. You know,
right. I mean, like, am I the only guy getting taken by these guys?
Yeah. Yeah. And it turns out they got a whole train of people that they've done it to. We've never heard a complaint before.
You're right. You know, yeah. What I find interesting is almost all of the true experts I know, like the people who are really good at what they do, whatever that is, they, you know, they've learned to put the best foot forward and be confident about what they do. And that's great because they really do know what they're doing.
Yeah.
But a lot of them struggle with the imposter syndrome. Like they think, oh, okay, so I've done this successfully in the past, but can I do it again? And was it pure luck? Like literally one of the best copywriters in the world admitted to me, like, yeah, I just got this new project and got to tell you, I'm struggling with it because I'm just wondering, okay, so I've had, you know, hundreds of controls for boardroom, you know, like
a
track record that nobody has. But, you know, I wondered, did I just get lucky? You know, can I do this again? I'm like,
wow,
holy smokes, you know? And it seems like the guys who truly believe their own publicity, you know, are the most incompetent and the most, and sociopaths too, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking of the world of internet marketing and all the characters. And it's like that Star Wars scene where he walks into the bar and there's all these weird creatures with, you know, 10 heads and long, you know, elephant noses and stuff. That's how I look at so many of the people in that world. I mean, I would, yeah, be careful, folks. Don't think that way. Like, don't, this guy sounds like he's making a miserable life for himself, you know? I mean, it's probably why he's so good, you know, he never takes it for granted. He never assumes that he's good. So but it seems like a torturous way to get there.
It does seem torturous. Although I read this study a while back, I wrote about it in my newsletter. They amongst writers, they weren't talking just about copywriters, but writers in general, at this writers conference, this psychologist started doing, basically clinical diagnostic, a questioning, testing them for the diagnosis of depression.
Yeah.
Like a really high percentage of writers, you know, met that clinical diagnostic criteria for depression. And that seems to be a common theme I'm seeing amongst just entrepreneurs, not just writers or copywriters.
Like, interesting.
This dealing with depression, you know, because it's what drives a lot of people on, that sense of dissatisfaction and like, oh, you know, I'm not good enough, or this is not good enough, I need to do better. It's like, it's a very negative thing and it's a very miserable way to live, but it is what seems to drive a lot of people.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I can see some of that myself for sure. You know, like I have a vision of how I want it to be and I want it to be that way now. Whereas the rest of the world is like, it's pretty good. Things are pretty good. Don't push too hard. I mean, I remember when I used to have jobs as a kid, I remember once working in this was an interesting job. So it was a, I can't even call it a factory because they didn't make anything, but it was this huge factory-like place in northern New Jersey. And this was when I was a kid, so we're talking many, many decades ago. Boxes would come from China. We would open them, and we would put them in Lane Bryant boxes. I don't know if you know what Lane Bryant is. It's a label for women who are ample, you know? So that was the whole job that this quote fact, and it employed hundreds of people. And that's all we did all day. I didn't have that job very long, but I had it because I needed to eat. And open the Chinese box, put it in the Lane Bryant box, open the, but the reason I bring that up was everybody was trying to figure out how not to do the job or how to do it as slowly as possible or how to screw it up as massively as possible. And I was like, let's do it. Let's get these boxes going, you know? and at one point, the guy that was the foreman, he said, you're not from around here, are you?
You're messing up the system, man.
He was kind of happy to see me, but he didn't know what to do with me because I was actually trying to get the thing done. This was so unusual to him to see this.
You never would have made it as a civil servant.
Oh my God.
Like I had a training officer who told me, so he wasn't a training. I had three training officers. Two were really good. Yeah. But one guy, this one veteran I rode with once, you know, and this sums up the mindset of every civil servant and probably everybody who works at that factory job like you. And he's like, well, they can work me hard or they can work me long, but they can't work me hard and long. You know, like, do not push it. You know, don't set the bar too high. We need to keep the bar really right. Low if that's what they're always going to expect from us.
That was it. That's it. Keep the bar low. Keep the bar. So as an entrepreneur, you just can't think that way. Whatever you're doing, you want to do it really well, you know, faster, better, more, you know. And so I guess living in a world where the average person does not think that way, it might tend one towards a touch of depression or anger, you know. Yeah, it's not all glamour.
No, that's for sure. We are definitely, we're whatever you want to call us, outsiders. We're just weird compared to the rest of the world.
I like that. There's a new term kind of floating around called outliers. You know, so we're not outsider. Makes me think like, gee, I'm separate from humanity, right? Outlier makes me think, well, I'm part of humanity. I'm just on one edge of it. You know,
like that makes a lot of sense.
Here's the norm. You know. 9 to 5, long coffee breaks, don't do too much. And then here's people that actually want to get stuff done. And so we're the outliers.
That's for sure.
Hey, speaking of getting stuff done, maybe we could talk about, you're seeing some people are doing great, you know, and we're not, by the way, if anybody mistakes that we're gloating, we're sure not. I would take all the gains that I've made and give them all back if we could undo this disaster that we've rained on. It's billions of people with a B, because it's not just US, right? The whole, I'm connected with Guatemala a little bit. They got all the campesinos wearing the masks and locked up in their houses. Those people, if they don't work today, they don't eat today. They haven't been able to work for 2.5 months. So anyway, neither Dan nor I are gloating. I'd gladly be talking about 10 headline tips and 5 ways to get your customers' attention. We are business people and you're business people, listeners. So let's talk about the people that are doing well and that, in fact, you can do well in this environment. Any, using that as a jump off point, bring anything to mind to talk about?
I've noticed something pretty interesting. Now, granted, I don't have this knowledge firsthand. This came from one of my knights about his clients. So I do have knowledge firsthand. One of my clients is in what you call the prepper niche, right? Mm-hmm. So yep. and they sell, you know, they sell stuff to people who prepare for disasters like this or the zombie apocalypse or whatever. And, you know, I hit them up when this finally really hit big time and said, hey, how's it going? And they're like, doing fine. Sales are holding steady. And then a few weeks later, I'm like, how's it going now? Like, oh yeah, things are going great. You know, offers are, you know, conversion is up. They're doing great. As I suspected, most people in the prepper niche would be doing great. And then I hear from one of my knights who has a client who is in the prepper niche, who without even trying, literally just gave up, like just threw in the towel. And it's not like he was seeing things tank. He's like, things are going to go to hell in a handbasket. I'm done. And just like gave up in a, in a market that he could probably be doing really well in.
Wow.
So I think, you know, I'm not going to say that, you know, who cares what's happening in the economy? It's all based on what you do and your attitude. Well, I don't believe that, but I do believe attitude is a big part of it. And look at the difference, you know, the same niche, for all intents and purposes, same products. One guy's doing great. The other guy just, you know, curled up in a fetal position and gave up.
Wow. Wow. That's a very important lesson right there. That's crazy. I mean, he had the customers. The customers were already bought into the idea that the apocalypse is near. He had the products. He had the infrastructure. And he just turned the lights out.
Just turn the lights out.
Wow. You can't help that kind of a mentality. So I guess lesson one, don't have that mentality. My God. You know, I'm going to go off a little on a tangent here, but there's a writer called Indrees Shah. I-N-D-R-E-S. Indrees Shah. S-H-A-H. Indrees Shah. And he's written 20 books. And most of them are collections of what he calls teaching tales. And they're cool. They're like a page or a page and a half. And they're ancient. They're like, they've been around for centuries, millennia. And they kind of make you think. So one of the teaching tales that he recounts, this is directly on the line of what you're talking about. There was this school, you know, of seekers. And one of the members was just a fuck up. You know, he just couldn't make anything happen for himself. Everything was a disaster he did. And so his fellow students went to the master and said, Master, you know, we'll call him Johnny. Johnny just can't catch a break. Can we do something for him? Can we help? Can you do something to help him? And he said, yes. I want you to take, here's a bag of gold. I want you to put it in the middle of the bridge. It's a little bridge. It's not one of these, not the George Washington Bridge, but it's like a little footbridge. Put it right in the middle of the bridge with no one else around, when no one else is around, and tell Johnny to cross the bridge. They said, oh, great. Oh, this is going to, he's just so much gold. This is going to change Johnny's life. It's going to be fantastic. So Johnny, they bring him to there. They put the gold there. They, hey, Johnny, walk across the bridge. He goes, oh, well, okay, whatever. So he walks across the bridge right past the bag of gold. And they asked him, Johnny, what happened? He goes, I suddenly was inspired by the idea of what it would be like to try to walk across the bridge with my eyes closed. In other words, some people are just so screwed up. they're shooting. You can't help them. You can have sympathy for them, compassion, treat them as a fellow human being, you know, but you literally can't help them. I don't know. For some reason, I always think of that story whenever I deal with somebody who you can see all they need to do is A, B, and C, right? It's not even rocket science. And they're going to not only get out of their predicament, they're going to thrive. And they just can't. They decide to close their eyes while they're walking the bridge, right? And they just walk right past the bag of gold that the guy put there. And the master knew that this was going to happen. He knew he was going to get his gold back. He knew he had that big bag of gold was coming back to him. He had no worries that Johnny was going to actually, the lone man on the bridge with a bag of gold right in his path, he had no doubt that Johnny was going to walk right past it. So
that's a great analogy.
Isn't it? So Shaw's full. He's got hundreds of stories like that. And I find myself referring to them almost daily to try to understand, you know, what I see in the world, you know. But anyway, that's a little literary aside. So good. So that's lesson one is like, don't crawl up. Don't, what do you call it? crawl into a fetal position and die. Okay, so lesson number one. What else have you observed out there?
I'm seeing people who have taken this as an opportunity to try to strengthen the relationship with their customers and prospects. And I think that's like the perfect response. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, if sales have slowed, well, there's still something you can do. You can continue to build that relationship. And my preference for doing that is via the written word, because I feel like that's my forte. That's the best way for me to do it. But it doesn't have to be that way. Mm-hmm. Like I noticed Dave D doing this with his list with videos. He's doing, I think, doing like a daily video now. And he's and that's exactly what he should do, because he's really good on video. He's really good in person from the stage or on video. So I view that as seeds planted, or you know, you're sticking every day, you're sticking more and more and more and more money in this account that is eventually going to yield mm-hmm. a return, even mm-hmm. if it's in your present market or niche or business or whatever, even if it's not yet. I see that as yielding big results. I see that as a no lose proposition. No, one way or another, just by doing that, it's going to pay off.
Great. You know, there's another way to look at that too. It's like, these are your customers, remember? These are the people who theoretically you want to help, right? And so maybe the only way you can help them now is just talk to them. Maybe there's not a blessed other thing you can do for them. So, you know what I mean? So if someone's got that mentality in the right place, which I think Dave has, you have, the people that are doing this have, they just naturally do the right thing, which is, I'm not going to hide. I'm not going to disappear. I'm not going to send. What's cracking me up, I don't know if you react the same way. I have people, I'm getting mail from people who are acting like it's 2019. Like there is no economic shutdown. There's no COVID. There's no, you know, everything's the way it was. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're right. I think you got to kind of talk about the elephant in the living room occasionally.
Yeah, I agree. Wouldn't it be great if we could ignore it and things would go on as normal, but it doesn't seem to be an option.
Yeah. What would you say? I mean, I've kind of maybe gone, you know, I'm an outlier as always. I've kind of spent a lot of time talking about the great shutdown, the scamdemic, more than business, actually. I'm now getting, all right, now let's do what I do best, which is the business stuff. But I may have been an outlier in addressing the elephant. Where do you feel you've fallen into, and where do you see that success, people that are successful in this time, where they're falling? Are they 50-50? Are they, you know, is there a way to put a number to it?
That's a good question. I keep up with your materials and your videos, and also with Brass Check, the information you're publishing there, and like a couple other people, but that's about it. You know, like I don't even watch the news anymore.
Good.
Because, you know, first of all, I want to be informed. I want to know what's going on, because that helps me make the right decisions. But then just to balance that out, I'm just going to tell you how it affects me personally, because this may apply to others. If I let the fear take hold, because, you know, I start projecting out like, you know, wow, 2008 was bad for me. Like the business just was cut in half practically overnight. I had a supplement business back then. You know, so I thought, geez, it was bad. You know, I made it through. I did stuff and, you know, came back, my mind starts thinking all that stuff and the fear starts taking hold. And so that is really not productive for me, because that affects my actions. Like then I'm afraid if I allow that loop to keep going, I'll be like that guy in the prepper niche who's like, I give up, forget it, you know. But I know even in subtle ways that if if I focus on the fear, it starts affecting my actions. And then that, you know, directly affects my business and stuff. So I find, I find like a balance. I need to be informed to make correct decisions. But then, you know, at some point I have to just make the decision like, hey, I know marketing, I know human nature, you know, whatever happens, I know how to sell stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just going to move forward with doing what I know how to do. And even if it doesn't produce immediate results, it's, you know, I'm planting seeds that are going to happen later. Like I said earlier, I figured I can't go wrong with doing things to strengthen the relationship with my list. So I'm going to, you know, double up my efforts on that. I guess that's the balance. And maybe also being a tad bit delusional just to play mental tricks with myself. Like, you know what? I'm a direct response marketer. I know this stuff well. I know how to sell in print. And, you know, things are booming for me. And that's more of like an attitude check for me, just to make sure I don't backslide into that.
Gotcha.
Oh, woe is me. Forget it. Let's give up.
Gotcha. Yeah, we all have, you know, our own unique psychologies. You might remember this, but when we had that reunion, that system seminar reunion in Chicago, we were talking about something, and I said to the group, I'm more comfortable when the world's on fire. I don't know if you remember me saying
that. I remember that.
And that's true for me. You know, when things are normal, I'm like, God, this is so boring. You know, it's like I can't get motivated. Perry did an interesting thing recording. He reminded me of something which I'd forgotten, that the system seminar started literally in the smoldering crater of 9/11 and the .com crash. You know, we started promoting that in early 2002. You know, people don't remember or are too young to know. You could get on an airplane and there'd be like five of you on a 747. You'd go to a hotel and they would treat you like a long lost relative who they wanted to see. And we made deals with hotels like you couldn't believe. We practically had them paying us to use their meeting rooms, you know, just to bring bodies into their hotel. So, and then I guess too, it affected me. You know, I grew up in the 70s. My teenage years were the 1970s in New York City, when New York City was the murder capital of the U.S., at least, if not the world. And I used to have to take a train through the South Bronx twice a day to and from high school. We smelled burning buildings on the platform.
Wow.
You know, there were two to three burning buildings in the South Bronx 24/7, 7 days a week, nonstop for that entire period. There was always something on fire.
Wow.
Yeah. So I only bring that up because that's my background. So now I realize not everybody has a background like that. So it's hard. I'm not saying I can't be scared. I can definitely be scared. Definitely. We all have the physical equipment, you know, the neurological wiring to be scared out of our minds, you know. But I just expect the world to be a cluster fudge, you know. So when it is, I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, this is familiar.
That's a good approach because, I mean, you expect that and that because that's probably what it's going to be. I mean, when has it not been that in the entire course of recorded history?
Right. So it's a helpful attitude to have. And people might think, oh, it's so depressing and it's so dark. But, you know, there's moments when it's great. And I think the moments when it's great are even more more poignant or more emphatic, you know. It's like, wow, you know, no one's shooting at me right now.
I get a brief respite.
Yeah, this is great.
I will enjoy it because I know it will be brief.
Yeah. There was a guy, I know his name, John Reed, R-E-E-D. and really good real estate investing, managing advisor, really good guy. And he had gone to West Point. And, you know, West Point, they had this thing called Hell, I think it's Hell Week or Hell Month. It might go on for a month. I don't know. Where they, the upperclassmen literally make your life miserable. Like it's 3 a.m, you're finally getting that first 10 minutes of sleep that you desperately need. And some guys come in and start banging pots right by your ear and drag you out of your bed by your ankles and throw a bucket of cold water on you and tell you to run a mile. You know, that kind of, and it goes on and on and on and on, and, which is perfect training for combat because that's what it's going to be like. You know, it'd be 100 times worse, but that gives you a flavor of what it's going to be like, right? So he said the way he survived was he didn't try to survive. He just tried to hang on to the next moment where there was a gap in the mayhem that he could enjoy, a meal. Like they didn't hassle them when they ate. They allowed them to actually sit down and eat meals. So he would just look forward to that next moment of normality. And he would string that together one after another, after another, after another. I thought that was brilliant, brilliant advice for how to go through hell.
Oh, that's a great lesson. Yeah. Wow. That's a great lesson for staying sane while you're going through it.
Yeah. And I think historical perspective helps. I mean, if as bad as this is, and again, you know, for me right now, for you right now, for a lot of people right now, we're doing fine or maybe better than ever. Well, because I'm so egomaniacal, let me get you to put on the record. What was I telling you, Doberman Dan, to do for the last year when it came to finances? Put your money into
treasuries.
Right.
And verify,
hold your hand up and swear on a Bible that before COVID, you were just one of many people, but you're the guy I have on the line right now. Anybody that asked me, I said, buy treasuries. It's a no-brainer. Buy treasuries, buy treasuries, buy treasuries. And anybody that bought treasuries made money during the crash because the interest rate went down, which meant the value of your treasuries went up. So I just need a record. I need a documentation of that I'm not making this up, that I actually did give people really good advice about this.
Yeah, that's right. And on top of that, when I read it in your book, Financial Independence Day Blueprint, I should have done it then because I heard it then, like years before you told it to me personally.
And then I had a funny experience. I was on one of Perry's things in 2017. And Perry was asking me, Ken, all this craziness can't just keep going on and on. What should we do? And I said, well, keep an eye on the stock market, keep an eye on the exit door because this won't go on forever. And so somebody wrote me just recently and said, thanks to you, I got out of the stock market in 2017, thanks to that call. And I wanted to tell him, well, if you had actually been my client, instead of just getting a snippet in 2017, you would have stayed in the market pretty much until the summer of 2019, and you would have bought treasuries, and you would have, whatever you didn't lose by being out of the market, you would have made, you know, 30, 40% on top of that had you been a client. So to everybody out there that's not a client, a word to the wise, don't take these little snippets and think, well, I get it now. You know, there's an ongoing process here that we're engaged in here at Round Table, you call it?
Knights of the Round Table.
Knights of the Round Table, you know. So if you like what Dan's doing, pick somebody and follow them, you know. I have a thing called the System Club. I don't think you can make it by getting like being a magpie. You know, you get a little thing from this person and a little thing from this person, a little thing from this person. And that could help. But I mean, for instance, I did a deep dive into J. Abraham first, because that's the first guy I encountered. And then when I met Dan Kennedy's work, deep dive into Dan Kennedy's work. I listened to other people and I got a little bit of stuff here and there. But it's that deep dive into someone that knows what they're talking about that really helps. So I get Dan's newsletter. It's one of the only newsletters I get. One of the only newsletters I read. It's good.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm kind of amazed. I'm like, where do you come up with all this stuff? This would kill me if I tried to produce this much original content.
Well, if we talk about all the video and audio content you're producing for the System Club, and on top of that, for your other outside projects, you've beat me on content creation.
Yeah, but you go through the intense work of writing it down and putting it on paper. Guys, that's a lot of work. If you don't do it, it's a lot of work. Because like I can just sort of talk and bullshit around. And I mean, maybe it's good content, but it's not sitting there and making sure everything's spelled correctly and then going back and polishing it and figuring out what's the best way to open, what's the best way to end, and then getting it into an 8-page newsletter. So I feel you're doing more.
That process probably qualifies as a mental illness, actually.
we're all different, and thank God there are writers. Certainly after, every time I pick up a book, I'm like, wow, some guy sweat blood to put what he knew into this book, and I just, here it is in my hands. And I don't have, maybe I paid $10 for it or $20, and I'm getting a lifetime of experience that's the great, reading is the greatest leverage, or listening to podcasts too, if it's a good podcast, the greatest leverage you can get.
I never understood people who didn't want to either read or take in new information that way through audios or whatever. I forget who the quote is attributed to, but I heard a long time ago, it's something like people who don't read or people who refuse to read, it's the same as not being able to read.
Yeah. Yeah. I you might've had a bad experience in school, or maybe you had a mean reading teacher, but you got to get over it. And if you can't get over it, get audiobooks. I can't even imagine surviving without this constant influx of new and sometimes and very often quote old information, just being reminded. I mean, why do professional athletes do spring training? Because they got to remember how to bunt, how to swing a bat, how to throw. I mean, they know how to do it, but you can forget in the off season.
Absolutely.
So, there was this great thing. I love telling the story. It was at the, I always forget the name of it, the Titans. And Brian Kurtz had all these people together. And he had Greg Renker of Gunty Renker, right? Biggest infomercial business, thousand employees, billion a year, top of his game. And I think he said the most important thing anyone could ever say. And he said this: we should all spend 2 hours a day reviewing the fundamentals. And I'm like, yeah, man, that's it. That's it. That's the best advice you can give anybody. You could put everything else aside. Just keep that in your mind,
It was funny because I think in my mind, I was imagining, the guy had such a big, successful business that like all the rookies in the room were thinking, great, here's going to be the secret. He's going to reveal the secret. They got special technology, or they know how to game the system, or they know all this super secret stuff. And then he revealed that about the basics.
Yeah.
Actually, that was the secret.
Yeah, really. It really is. Really is. And it's anything that's performance-based, where you actually have to do something as opposed to bullshit about something. Direct marketing, I always loved it because it's, you got to produce. It's all about producing. And there are other fields like that, like music, right? I mean, you either can play that thing or you can't. And if you can't play it, it's because you didn't practice. You didn't master the fundamentals, right?
Exactly.
And martial arts. I love martial arts for that reason, too. It's like you didn't practice. That's why you're unconscious on the mat right now and that other guy's jumping around. Because you didn't train, and he did, and it shows. you know? And what did he train in? Did he learn the secrets of the ages, you know, the mind projection? No, he ran every morning. He worked out on the speed bag, you know, he punched the heavy bag. I got to tell you that, I don't know if you've ever seen this. This is so, everyone should Google this. Hopefully it's still up or YouTube it. I live across the river from where Mike Tyson used to train when he was a kid in Catskill, New York. And you can still go to that gym. It's still open. It's on top of the police department, interestingly enough.
Is it a commercial gym or just?
It's open? Still what it, well, I mean, you know, his teacher, you know, is gone. You know, the guy that trained him died. So it's still that was sort of his pri, you know, that was sort of that guy's private, you know, domain. I guess he rented it from the city. You know, so it's a 3-story building, and the top floor is where he put his gym. And he figured, hey, city's renting this space, I'll get it. So now it's used for a guy that's teaching kids how to box. But it's very low key. I mean, this is by no means a glamorous, super high tech, you know, high end facility. This is like a room, you know, that's it, you know. So you can actually go, you have to go at the right time and you have to knock on the door and ask somebody to open the door for you. But you can actually go and see the room, the gym, and it's a room. It's not even a gym in a sense, right? You can see the room where Mike Tyson became Mike Tyson. Right? And everybody thinks he was a monster and he was just this genetic freak, and some of that's true. I mean, I think at 14 he was the size of a longshoreman. Huh. You know, muscularly he was already all there, you know, but he had to train like a maniac, and he trained in fundamental stuff. And there's this video on YouTube of him, you know, the medicine ball, that big heavy ball.
Mm-hmm.
And his trainer, not his main trainer, but one of the guys that worked in the gym, was just throwing the medicine ball right at his gut. I mean, right at the solar plexus. I mean, right at the ribs. Like, where are you? Like, if I got hit once, I'd be done. Like, I'd probably, maybe it would take me 6 months to recover from it. And Tyson's just standing there. This guy's whacking him with this medicine ball. I mean, wow. It looked like cruel and inhuman punishment, right? And you could see Tyson's bored, right?
He's bored with it.
Yeah, and yet that's one of the fundamentals. If you're going to be a boxer, you got to be able to get hit and hit hard and not fold. So that's one of the fundamentals of boxing, and he did it. You know what I mean? So, you know, we see the top of the pyramid. We see him in Las Vegas, you know, when he was fighting those, you know, multi-million-dollar bouts. We don't see him in the gym for hours and hours getting hit with the medicine ball from all angles until it became trivial.
Good right? point.
So fundamentals. They're not trivial. They're what made Mike Tyson Tyson. They're what made Doberman Dan Doberman Dan.
You know, speaking of that, you said something at that system seminar reunion in Chicago that we were at, that it's the same thing along the lines of the fundamentals. It was pretty breakthrough for me. And I looked around the room. I thought, did everybody else get this? Because here's what you said. You said how most wealth is created with business owners is you have a fairly mundane business and you run your train from point A to point B. When everybody gets on at point A, you charge them. They get off at point A, point B. People get on at point B, you take them to point A, you charge them. You just run that train back and forth between point A and point B. And that was pretty breakthrough for me because like entrepreneurs are always chasing the brass ring or at least
they're laying new track.
Always laying new track. That's even a better analogy.
Instead of running the train back and forth, it's like, let's build a train through the Andes Mountains, you know, and through the Amazon, and it'll kill 100,000 workers, but we'll have a train, you know.
And my train is, you know, my train, you know, because I was running a new track where there wasn't a bridge. Now my train went off the cliff and I'm trainless. I've lost everything. Like if I would have just finally after 9 years of serial failures, when I did finally have that first success is that business. If I just would have kept running the train from point A to point B, I would have made so much more money than constantly trying to lay new track, or like, hey, this market sucks. I see that guy over there and he's making a bazillion dollars a minute. So I'm going to start a whole new business.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I have to credit where credit's due. I got that analogy from Joe Cosman.
From and, Joe Cosman, no
for,
kidding.
For young folks who don't know who that is, when I was a kid, if you went to anybody's other kid's house, they would have had an ant farm, right? I didn't get an ant farm, but everybody else did. And but they all had them. Joe Cosman was the guy that came up with the idea of selling 2 cents worth of plastic for 10 bucks, which was a lot of money in those days, and calling it an ant farm.
I had one of those things. You poor, you did, right? You were a poor, deprived child. Every child should have had an
I was, man. We didn't even have color TV.
Oh, my God. How did you survive?
I don't know. I used to have to go to friends' houses and watch color TV. It's terrible. It's terrible. But I got that from Joe Cosman. And, you know, there was a world. This might be helpful to folks. There was a world before the internet. And giants roamed the earth. And they knew a lot of shit. And Joe Cosman was one of them. Gary Halbert was one of them. Dan Kennedy bridges both worlds, you know. By the way, Dan Kennedy is one of the best internet advisors you're ever going to find. People don't get that, but I just gave you a little hint, guys. So there's a lot to learn from the pre-internet days. And, you know, our profession was developed in two big waves. One, like the late 19th century, which was kind of a boom period. And the big challenge was, gee, most people live on a farm or in a small town, and they're starting to make a lot of money, and they can't even buy stuff. This was the problem of the late 19th century, right? So Sears and Montgomery Ward came along and said, well, we'll put it all in a book and mail it to them, and they can send us money. So that was like the first wave of our profession. But the second wave of our profession was the Depression. That's when a lot of the great innovation, a lot of the great practitioners, John Caples, you know, and people like that. And during the Depression, you had to be sharp to make money. No one handed it to you. And you had to be really good at conveying value for the money that people were getting. You know, I think during a gold rush era, you know, kind of like we had pre-scamdemic, it's more like FOMA. I love that. Fear of missing out. Do you know that, mm-hmm. that analogy, FOMA? Now, and so you could sell a lot of junk. I mean, I always like to be value driven, but a lot of people sold a lot of junk on the FOMA principle. But I think now people are really looking at their pocketbooks and thinking, okay, if I buy this, I'm not going to be able to buy something else. It better be good. You know, who is that guy? Oh, this is terrible that I'm going to. Sales trainer, great sales trainer.
Like contemporary one or in
older,
the past?
Well, he's still alive. Older guy. Well, guys, I apologize to you and to him for not knowing. But he made a really simple point. He goes, there's a scale. Your customer's money is here. What you're offering is here. This thing better get really, the thing that you're offering better get really, really heavy and really, really valuable. And the money should seem like nothing in comparison.
That's great advice. That's not a Zig Ziglar thing, is it?
It's not Ziglar, and it's not, someday I'll remember and I'll put a footnote to this thing.
That's great advice.
Yeah. I heard that pre-internet, thank God, and that always stuck with me. It's like, how am I going to make what I've got look way more valuable than the money in that guy's pocket? Because we've all had that experience where, let's say you use a dramatic example. You've been out hiking. It's 110 degrees. You forgot to bring water. Somebody's selling bottles of water for 10 bucks. Do you care?
At that point, no.
would you sit there and go, well, I ain't paying $10 for no bottle of water? No, you're grateful to, you can't pass that money over fast enough. By the way, if people, I always take marketing lessons from everything. I think one of the things that's going on right now, if we go back to the scamdemic world, and I've seen Fauci do this before. By the way, if people that don't know, Fauci's that grandfather, seemingly grandfather dude that sits next to Trump at these conferences or used to. What people don't know about Fauci, he's an MD, yes. He's a researcher, sort of. But what he really is a embedded DC bureaucrat. He's had the same job for 36 years. Now, Dan, you've worked for civil service. What does it mean when a guy has the same job for 36 years?
Well, first of all, that's a powerful dude there.
Yeah.
Somebody who keeps that job for 36 years. To be able to keep a civil service job for 36 years, you got to know the game and the system, and you got to play the game. He's one of the best at playing the game.
There you go.
Which I just, my opinion means he's a sociopath. That's just, I could be mistaken. I don't think I am.
I'll concur. And you have to ask, who is Fauci fronting for? Because it ain't him that's propping him up. I mean, by definition, you cannot prop yourself up. You have to be propped up. I would venture to say it's probably the pharmaceutical industry. Just a guess.
That connection makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So as long as he makes that very powerful, very rich, very influential industry happy, he keeps his job, he keeps his perks. And just as a side note, and I'm amazed that this doesn't get talked about much because it's a not so hidden secret in the world of medical science. He is the 800-pound gorilla in the medical research world because he controls the NIH funds for infectious disease research. So if you want to be in that game, you've got to please Tony Fauci or you're gone. Right? So this is a powerful guy. So if we put this, I think I've made the case here. I don't think I'm saying anything that's crazy or hard to believe or hard to understand. So what is Fauci's end game here? And this goes to the, I've got money in my pocket, but what you've got is way more valuable. So I'm going to throw the money at you because the money is worthless in compared to what you have. The goal is when these drugs start coming online, whether they're good or not, and they probably won't be good because he has a terrible track record. That also, sorry to take this on this tangent, but I just have to say it. This guy has a terrible track record of drug development. Like horrendous. But he doesn't seem to be bothered by it. And the news media doesn't seem to be asking him about it. But anyway, the whole end game here, and we can learn from him. I mean, you can learn from sociopaths. You don't want to be a sociopath, but he's creating a dynamic where he's creating a stampede. When that drug's ready, boy, it's going to fly off the shelves, good, bad, or indifferent. Probably it's going to be bad. He's already said, by the way, it's going to be bad. I even have it on tape. He goes, but it's a first start. Oh, it's our first step. We'll kill a few. He didn't say this. But we'll kill a few 100,000 people, but it'll be part of the learning process. So this ability to create. So we have to give the guy his due. He is a master at stage managing the rush to the stage, you know, or the crazed buying. You know, it's like what did the department stores used to do? You know, they would have these crazy sales on Black Friday, and everybody would line up, you know, and they'd turn it into a thing. Totally irrational. Why would anybody in their right mind want to get involved in a mob scene where you could break an arm or a leg, and you're not even going to get what you went there for in the first place? Anyway. Apple did that too, right? They stage managed people waiting online overnight to be first in line to get the new iPhone. We don't have to approve of these things, but we should observe them and learn from them.
For us marketers, it's a fascinating study. If you can take the emotional reaction to the incredible evil behind what's going on right now. I mean, it's an interesting marketing study. Like they're using Pavlovian conditioning to push people into taking the desired action that they want everybody to take because it will enrich certain people, which, you know, is like, is what we do as marketers. Some people don't.
Yeah.
Some people not ethically, but you know, when you have something of value, I mean, you're following the same process, right? You need to make sure that the potential customer understands that value, you know, so it needs to be communicated away. And frankly, there's emotional manipulation going on. And I mean, just, you know, let's call a spade, some Pavlovian conditioning going on where when you really know the value of whatever you're selling and you know that it can make that big of an impact in somebody's life, when you present it in a way like, you know, imagine just for a minute, you don't take this action that I want you to take,
right,
you know,
right.
And now all of a sudden, you know, your business loses 80% of its business overnight and you're scared to death, wondering how you're going to put food on the table, you know, pay the bills. I mean, we're all using that process. The difference is, you know, they're doing it for evil.
Yeah. We're dramatizing the situation, you know. I often think of direct mail as showbiz in a way. You know, you need the big opener, you know. The shot rings out, somebody screams, like, what just happened, you know? Gene Schwartz was always emphatic that everybody should go see super popular movies because they became popular because they were good at pushing the buttons, you know? And I think his formula was dialogue, car wreck, dialogue, explosion, dialogue, shootout, dialogue, you know, whatever. And so that's a good model too, to have in your, you know, you have to be rational at certain points in your sales letter, but other times you do need to be dramatic. I think you do need to fire off some fireworks. And that's legit. And I think the issue, and you said you brought it up, and I think it's really important. Is this something that's actually good for my customers or my prospects? Would this be good if this guy got this? And I think the average person tries to make sure that's so, you know, but these are, you know, it's a literal double-edged sword. You could use it as a scalpel to, you know, save somebody's life with a life-saving operation, or you can stab them in the back with the same device, you know? So, and I do think, you know, given that we're not going to become the Faucis, the next Faucis of the world, I think it probably makes sense to be on the other side and like think, what value can I produce here, provide here? In fact, maybe that's something we should talk about. Like, we know how to sell. I know how to sell. You know how to sell. There's all kinds of great material on how to sell. What do we know about how to create value? We used to talk about that. And I don't mean you and me, but I mean we marketers, direct marketers, ethical direct marketers, used to talk about that. And I think that conversation is worth renewing.
I agree. In our defense, I think when we talk marketing with other business owners and marketers, you know, we're talking marketing, we're talking numbers, we're talking how to sell, conversions, I mean, all that stuff. But I think one thing we probably need to be more vocal about as marketers when we talk about that is, I think we just assume that the audience we're talking to knows obviously this stuff should only be used to sell products that provide value to people's life, you know, like, but maybe we should be more vocal about that and talk about creating value in addition to all the marketing stuff.
Yeah, like the first question maybe should be, and this would actually help in selling, by the way, I believe. The first question always should be, where's the value in this for the person on the other side of the counter? You know, describe it for me. Sometimes the values, you know, you were talking earlier about a copywriter who's really great, but never felt that he was. There are often business people that are really great, that are providing a really good service, but they've never sat down or had somebody sat down with them and enumerate all the tremendous things that their service does. And so I think those are the kinds of people that we want to work with and talk to and educate. You know, you're a good guy. You're doing great stuff. You're just not telling the whole story to the world. And maybe you're not dramatizing it enough. You know, there's some drama. You know, even if a guy's a shoemaker, there's drama in that. You know, if I'm a woman and I break a heel at my sister's wedding, I mean, and the shoemaker fixes that heel, that's a big thing you just did, you know? So maybe that's what this is about, right? You know, we're looking for the people that are actually doing great things and helping them convey that with more juice.
That's true. And you know what's really common with most people, like who provide a product or a service, they're just so, I mean, it's part of their daily lives. And there's a saying I ripped off from somebody else that I say a lot, you know, you can't see the picture if you're in the frame. And so most people are in the picture. And you start asking about what they provide, you're like, this is amazing. This solves a huge problem for so many people, but they're like, it's just what I do. You know, they actually kind of lose, they're not cognizant of the value that they provide just because it's common to them, you know, right. And it takes an outside guy like us to look at it in that way, like, holy smokes, this is hugely valuable, you know?
Yeah. So that may be a lesson here, you know, and if you're in business and you're not getting that response from at least some of your customers, maybe you need to look at your business. Like I'm never interested in putting a lipstick on a pig. You know, I just don't want to do it. And so that's maybe another lesson here. You know, maybe if somebody, well, I'm not going to say somebody's business is shaky these days because of this, that issue. It may be shaky because their customers are gone, or because they can't even deliver their business anymore. Have you encountered anybody that's been able to pivot real fast and take what they were doing and, you know, offer in a new or different way?
I have. I was really excited to hear this and a little proud, even though really I didn't have anything to do with it. But it was one of the nights in my marketing Camelot, and he had a martial arts studio, and it's brick and mortar. That was his business model. You sign up for classes, you come weekly or whatever it was, and he does classes. Well, that, you know, was shut down overnight. So this is not an online marketing guy. He was subscribing to my thing to get more students, in-person students, to a brick and mortar location. And he immediately figured out, you know, sometimes needing money, is a good thing, you know, right?
Focuses the mind,
you know? Now you got to innovate. I've done some of my best work when my back was against the wall and I thought I was going to get evicted, right? Right? So he knew he had to pivot. He immediately signed up for a Zoom account and he started doing his classes on Zoom. And he said he really didn't lose anybody, you know? Would they have preferred in person? Probably.
Okay.
But, you know, he kept the train going from point A to point B by Zoom. And then his question on the webinar, I do a weekly webinar for my nights. His question was, you know, so this got me to thinking. So I've done this pivot. What other opportunities are there? Mm. You know, and now he's thinking of, oh, you know what? I'm going to package up course material and sell it to them in a digital format. Mm-hmm. So he's, for all intents and purposes, he's taken what was this 100% brick and mortar location offline, and he's now created an online business.
You know, it seems so simple, but how many martial arts studios did that? 1 out of 10, 1 out of 100?
There were a lot who were just like that guy in the prepper space we talked about earlier, like, oh, well, I give up. I'm ruined.
Yeah. And you know, it was interesting. I imagine he did that pretty fast. He made that turnaround fast. And that was absolutely the right thing to do, obviously. But the reason it worked, I'm thinking, is there was this momentum. Kids were used to going to class every Thursday evening. Now what do? Oh, well, there's the Zoom class. Well, everybody else has got to do Zoom stuff for everything. This is normal. And so he transitioned from into a really abnormal scenario very smoothly, making it normal, making it, okay, of course I send the same amount of money. Is he charging the same amount, you think?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Oh man, you got to love that. So he didn't miss a beat.
And on top of that, he was excited because his brick and mortar location, obviously he's restricted within a geographic area.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Now he can promote this deal worldwide. He intends to go back to doing classes at his brick and mortar spot, I think because he likes it.
Yeah.
But now he's just created a new division of your business. What do you want to call a new business?
Yeah.
That can operate internationally.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah, good. That's a good one. I'm trying to think of, the takeout. Well, it was interesting there. Some restaurants have turned into mini groceries.
I've noticed that. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can get your dinner, but you can also get toilet paper and you can get all these basic things. You don't have to go to the depressing supermarket where everybody's wearing a mask. You can just go and, we know what the staples are. We know what people always need.
It's simply asking them. Okay, so when you're picking up your takeout, would you like to add some, rolls of toilet paper? Or I read about, I forget where it was. I'm thinking it was New Jersey, a creative restaurant that they wanted to up their takeout business. So they started including a roll of toilet paper.
Oh right.
I think a bar of soap and something else as a bonus. Like it wasn't, you didn't pay for it. It was an extra bonus for getting your takeout from them.
That's so brilliant. And that's old school. Talk about old school stuff. When I was a kid, this is hard to imagine, but there was a time when gasoline was so cheap that all the gas stations had to compete with each other. So if you got a tank of gas, they'd give you a steak knife.
I remember those.
You remember? Okay. So hey, come and get takeout from Joe's Diner and we'll give you a roll of toilet paper. Sounds like a good deal to me.
Can't lose. Like if it's coming down, well, I can get takeout from Subway or with Joe's, I'm getting a bar of soap and a roll of toilet paper. I'm going to buy from Joe's.
Yeah. Yeah. Adaptation. Well, we could probably go on a lot longer. I'm wondering if we kind of covered some of the main things, don't fold, check your mind. You really got to kind of cultivate your mind. For everybody, it's a problem for everybody, even if it's everyone, everyone's got to check them, check yourself, as they say.
Boning up on, even if you're not a copywriter, boning up on your copywriting skills, or however you want to call it, your ability to communicate in print or on a website or by email is always a good idea at any time. But I think, especially so now, because you might want to look at what you're using to promote your product or service for that same reason I talked about earlier, that you can't see the picture when you're in the frame. Maybe if you can have somebody else look at it, or if you can look at it more objectively and think, am I really communicating the value of what I offer? And, if not, maybe it's time to read up on your copy skills. And you gave the secret to that earlier when you were talking about, for 10 or 20 bucks, you can get a lifetime of experience from somebody else.
And interestingly enough, a lot of those guys were writing based on the experience of selling in a climate exactly like this.
Good point.
So it really comes full circle, 1930s, And everybody knows sell the steak. Sell the sizzle. Don't sell the steak, sell the sizzle, right? So that came from a guy named Elmer Wheeler, right? What people don't know about Elmer Wheeler was he wanted to be a writer. He wanted to be a journalist. And when the Depression came, his editor said, we don't need Elmer anymore, but if you want to sell ads, we got a job for you. And he's like, oh, I can't do that, Mr. Smith. I've never sold anything in my life. And then he realized, but I'm going to starve to death if I don't. So this sort of shy guy went out and started selling ads. And because he was a writer, he was really thinking about the language he used. And, you know, Wheeler was the guy that came up with, would you like fries with that? He came up with a whole bunch of things. And he created a whole business around it, ultimately. And that all grew out of, you know, being forced to go way out of his comfort zone. He wasn't a salesman. He wasn't an interpersonal guy. So didn't hurt him to get out of his comfort zone, ultimately.
That worked out pretty well for him.
It did. You know, going back to something we were saying earlier about, you know, basically ethics, he said another great line, which is so wonderful to guide direct marketers. Don't sell an empty box. We are capable of selling empty boxes, right? Especially you and I. We know how to do anything. We can do anything, but we don't do it, right? We make sure there's something in the box and then sell the hell out of it. That's legit. Don't sell an empty box. So if you're looking for moral guidance or ethical guidance, which I think, you know, we got to be thinking that way always, that he came up with another little, you know, how many words that is, that just sums up the whole thing.
Good advice.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's great to see you. I like this Zoom thing because Dan and I are on the phone often and we're just talking, you know, and I can kind of see Dan. He's looking good, you know, he's healthy looking. It's good, you know. Hey, like my fake Zen monastery background.
I love it. I haven't figured out how to do that yet. I'm going to find out.
You know, it was so weird. You're using Zoom, right?
Yeah.
I find it and then I can't find it again. And I lose my mind. And then I find it. One day I wanted to do a call with somebody. I've been fooling around and I put some crazy background and it was time for the call. And I swear you could have put a gun to my head and said, find the right background. I could not find it. Let me tell you, for Pete, cause I can't be the only, you know what I'm looking. I don't even know how to describe it.
I looked for a button and I couldn't, I was at my, the reason when we first came on the call, the reason my name said Uncle D and T or something was because the last Zoom call I did was with my family up in Columbus and nephew was using a background. I'm like, how did you do that? He goes, oh, it's a little button on the thing, but he was on a PC and it was different, you know? So I still haven't found the button to do a background.
There's this somewhere, if you go all over your Zoom thing, there's a little picture of yourself. At least I'm on an Apple. And then there's a tiny little thing you can barely see, right? You click on that. And then there's like this thing of verbal choices. And one of them says, no, it says settings. And then you click on that, and then there's backgrounds, and then you click on backgrounds, and then you're there. But I'm telling you, if someone came in right now with a shotgun, right, stuck it right in my back and said, find that button in your curtains, I'd say that's curtains, I guess, because I can't find it.
So you might be stuck with that Zen background the rest of your life now.
Well, I have to say, I spent a lot of time thinking about this, because the background of my office is chaos. I don't want people to know what goes on here. And I tried natural scenes, you know, waterfalls, you know, the Alps. And I'm like, well, that's phony. I'm not conducting business in the Alps, you know. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to go with boardroom, you know, a little boardroom, you know, like everything, chairs in place and a big conference table. And I go, that looks horrible, you know. So this Zen thing is kind of got a natural feel, but it's also got an organized sort of business-like feel. So that's how I went with the. And by the way, when you figure it out, and eventually you will, somehow, I wish I could tell you how, but you will, you can get a picture anywhere. This isn't, I got this off the internet somewhere.
Oh, you're not restricted to just anything. Zoom background.
Oh, you could have anything you want.
Oh boy, I'm going to have fun with this.
It is big fun. So I hope this call has been helpful for folks. I hope it's been inspiring. I didn't even introduce Doberman Dan. I think everybody knows who he is, but if you read the email, you know who he is. So one of the great educators in our field, been at it for years and years. I don't read many newsletters. In fact, I read Kennedy's and yours, and I'm done. I don't really need to go any further than that. So how do people get in touch with you if they want to know more about what you're up to?
Oh, best way to get into my world is just at DobermanDan.com.
That's easy. Mm-hmm. I bet you have a really cool squeeze page.
I do. It's, just going there, I think, will be an interesting study in what I call my just sell the damn thing system. You'll see. I'm not, yes, I do acquire opt-ins that way, but I'm not trying to acquire opt-ins. I'm trying to acquire buyers of my book because I've discovered that as far as value to my business, if someone spends money with me, even if it's just, whatever it is, $9 for the book, $9.95 for the book, they are infinitely more value to my business. Of course, we're not talking about their value as a human being, but I've done both models. The opt-in model, offer a freebie thing to get somebody to give you their email. And I've done the just sell the damn thing where the only offer is to buy something. You buy, right, or,
dear God,
or split you where the good Lord gets you. Or get you where the good Lord splits you. I've done both. This is kind of a hybrid though. You'll see the hybrid model. I'm still collecting opt-ins, but I'm immediately pitching my book to new people.
It's a great lesson. And that's also the title of your book, Just Sell the Damn Thing.
Right. Totally swiped from Gary Halbert, by the way.
Cause we sure, as an industry, we sure got off on the internet, especially on the internet side, people really got way, it's like you almost couldn't give somebody money. You had to go through 10, follow-up letters before the actual offer would come. I'm like, are you kidding me? But that's how people rolled for a while.
That wasn't an option for guys like you and me prior to the internet. I mean, with the only option that the bootstrap entrepreneur had was basically space ads in either a magazine or a newspaper and direct mail, like radio probably wasn't affordable. TV definitely wasn't, so we had to make a set. That was the only model,
right?
Right. We didn't, do an opt-in and romance them for 3 months, giving them free content because, we needed to make money, man. We had to pay media.
Yeah. Sell or die.
Absolutely. So I'm just doing that online,
Great. So everyone should check out DobermanDan.com. And Dan, great to see you. We got to do more of this.
Yeah, this was fun. I really appreciate the invitation. Been looking forward to this all week.
Great. Great. And I'll let you see this thing before we release it to the world.
Yeah, let me double check that I didn't say anything that could possibly get me into legals. I don't think we said anything.
Oh, no, we didn't. We'll just see we'll see what people can take, how much truth they can take.
Maybe people want to see our kibitzing about the current times before we actually got into the marketing stuff.
Maybe. All right. So long.
Thanks again, Ken.
Okay.
Have a good one.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.